Hello, I'm Matt Truman, and this is Theatre Voice. As well as being a weekly podcast, we're part of the Victoria and Albert Museum's Theatre and Performance Archive, a collection of material that aims to hold on to the ephemeral comings and goings that make up British theatre. This week's episode is very much in that spirit. It seems almost unthinkable today that a new comedy would run 6.5 years in the West End. Even Richard Bean's recent mega-hit One Man, Two Governors only managed 3. But it was pretty unthinkable even back in the 1960s, when new plays routinely opened in town. But Terence Frisby's anti-rom-com There's a Girl in My Soup bedded in for the long haul, stacking up more than 2,500 performances from 1966 on. It was, at the time, an unprecedented success. That phrase, anti-rom-com, captures something of a play that sat somewhere between the new wave of British theatre, those angry young men, and the old. On its opening night, there was a smattering of boos come curtain call, punters discontented that Guy didn't get Girl. In fact, for all its popular appeal, There's a Girl in My Soup cottoned on to several major splits in British society. Terence Frisby went on to a successful career, and the play was turned into a Brit flick in 1970, but I'll leave the critic Dominic Cavendish, Theatre Voice's founder, to tell you more about that. Here he is, sitting down for a chat with Terence Frisby.
You can't make a living, but you can make a killing, runs the old adage about life as a playwright. And killings don't come much bigger than the one enjoyed by Terence Frisby in the late 1960s, thanks to his phenomenally successful comedy, There's a Girl in My Soup. Remembered not least for having introduced the phrase, "My God, but you're lovely," into the lexicon, purred by an ageing Lothario TV chef and a part originally played by Donald Sinden, it ran for 6.5 years, making it, at the time, the longest running comedy in West End history, closing after more than 2,500 performances. Having premiered in London in 1966, it was staged on Broadway in 1967 and was made into an award-winning film in 1970, starring Peter Sellers as the gourmet chef Robert Danvers, who meets his match in an independent-minded teenager played on screen by Goldie Hawn. It was a wonder of a hit, but Mr. Frisby was no one-hit wonder. An actor, director and producer whose producing credits include bringing Wazza Albert from the Market Theatre Johannesburg to the West End. Among his other writings, there was his debut, The Subtopians, 1964, The Bandwagon, 1969, It's All Right If I Do It, 1977, Seaside Postcard, 1978, Rough Justice, 1994, and Funny About Love, which closed the decade in 1999. On television, aside from multiple plays, his series include Lucky Fellow with David Jason, and That's Love. Let's begin, though, by plunging straight into the soup. And perhaps I could begin by asking you, Terence Frisby, what was the starting point for that play?
I was a very serious-minded young writer in the 50s. I saw Look Back in Anger, and I had heard the clarion call. I'd heard The Messiah. And I was just left drama school when I saw that and went into rep and started writing at once. I wrote my first play in while I was in rep. And couldn't get it on. It's called The Subtopians, and it was very much under the influence of Osborne. And the new wave and all of that was all I cared about. But while I worked in rep, I did all of those plays that we in of the new wave hoped were going to supplant. And I learned to enjoy the structure of a play, the way things were put together, the way an audience reacted. And I learned a great deal of things about the carpenter, the well-carpentered, the well-made play. So, Subtopians finally went on. It belonged in the 50s. I didn't get it on until the 60s, and it was too late. And reviewers, when I finally got it to the Arts Theatre in 64, said, "It's all very good, but we've seen all this before." And they were absolutely right, but when I wrote it, we hadn't. So I was a bit peeved off about that. And Michael Codron said to me, "Bring me your next play." Michael Codron then ran the Arts Theatre, and he'd given me the access to it with my play. He said, "Send me your next play and I'll do it," he said in that way of his. "Send me your next play and I'll do it. Goodbye." And Meantime, as a result of my first play being on in 62, I had got my first TV commissions to write plays. My first one was about anti-capital punishment play, which went out on a Sunday night, play of the week, Sunday night, BBC, the big event of the week, and it was watched by three people throughout the country, the Director General of the BBC, I think, the head of drama, and my mother, because on the Palladium show, it was the first broadcast of a new group called the Beatles. So it crashed. And the BBC, they gave me carte blanche to write what I liked for the next one. And I wrote a film at about the same time about the bomb, and I wrote another play, which was finally done on BBC, about disestablishment of the Church of England. I mean, how you can't get more serious-minded than I was. So I went into the BBC at one point and saw this script editor, and he said, "Oh, Terry, I'm there." And he sort of kicked a pile of scripts, dusty scripts in the corner, and said, "I've got all these plays about the bomb and about Church of England and capital punishment. Can't you write us a romantic comedy?" And I said, "No, I'll write you..." I couldn't do that. I said, "No, I can do you an anti-romantic comedy." "Okay, fine. What are we going to call it?" I said, "I don't know. Mr. Danvers' Downfall," I said, because it'll be about a middle-aged man, I said, and a chick who puts a squib under him and upsets his life. So I went away and I wrote that and took it back. And this man had left his job, and another man was sitting there, a man called Roger Smith, well-known leftish script editor, dramaturg, and so on. And he gave me this play and said, "I don't think we want plays like this, Terry," and handed it back to me. And I said, "Well, I was commissioned to write it." And he said, "Oh, yes, we'll pay you." So I grabbed my script and went, because I already realised I had written the basis of a West End comedy. But I was writing for TV. I went home, altered it into a stage play. It was exactly the same thing that I'd set off to do, which was a three-legged structure: the battle of the sexes, the battle of the classes, and the battle of the generations. That was its structure. And this little chick I just told you about, off the street, brilliantly played by Barbara Ferris. And I sent it to Michael, and he did it. And that's how it came into being. By accident. Now, as for that dreadful title that I came up with, which is pure H.G. Wells, isn't it, Mr. Danvers' Downfall? When Robert Chetwin was appointed as director, who I approved of very strongly, I'd seen his work already, every time Michael, Bob and I met for casting sessions and all the rest of it, as we were in pre-production, we kept saying, bringing in lists of titles for us. What can we call it? And I had written a TV play about a social climber called You Should Hear Me Eat Soup. And Bob said, "Oh, bearing in mind what you said there about soup there, and this is about a gourmet, what about There's a Girl in My Soup as a title?" And I thought, oh, perfection, absolutely wonderful. And Michael said, "It's a bit cheap, isn't it? Don't you think it undermines the play a bit? I mean, you know, you've written a serious comedy about the sexual mores of the time and so on." I said, "I tell you what, we'll call it There's a Girl in My Soup until somebody thinks of a better one." Well, that wasn't going to happen, was it? I mean, there isn't a better title. I can say it because I didn't think of it. So there we are.
So the idea of a middle-aged, slightly lecherous, I suppose you could say, but certainly the ladies man, mm-hmm. of archetype, in a way, somebody who's has an aphrodisiac of televisual power, something that was almost perhaps becoming more the norm in the 1960s, that there were people, personalities, TV personalities, who had
There were plenty of them. There was I think someone had been on TV, and the most famous TV chef, a couple of women, but the most famous male was Robert Carrier, who was as gay as a bee, and so that didn't quite fit. But I sat down with Ivor, was sharing a flat with Ivor at some point, and I made him originally a lawyer, and I thought, that's a bit dull. And I sat down with Ivor, what should we make? What is the trendiest job we can give this man? And we came up with TV chef. And he was meant to be a peacock. I mean, in a sentence, what is There's a Girl in My Soup about? It's about man's inhumanity to woman. And he gets, you know, the the prey turns on the hunter.
A line, I suppose, today, to today's ears, we're so easily offended, aren't we? But he says, you don't make friends with a roast duck, you eat it.
Yes.
And I don't know whether at that time, there were gasps of outrage at the way he regarded women as sort of
carnivorous. No, in the West End, I wouldn't say there were gasps of outrage, because he didn't. The audience just laughed. But when we toured, before we came into London, we got few laughs. And the mayor of Wolverhampton walked out in the interval. He was so disgusted with it. The mayor's wife stayed. She was enjoying it. I remember we played Cardiff, and I sat there in one night in Cardiff, and the only things that got laughs were a few bits of visual gags. No lines got laughs, anything. It was eerie. And mind you, I was rewriting the play like mad, and I had done a rewrite on it, which, when Michael bought it, I said, that's just a draft, Michael, I'm going to improve it now. And I went home and I wrote it into the ground. All of the themes and everything I wanted to write about came out explicit on top instead of being implicit, which a play should be. And we did a reading of it. The first reading of There's a Girl in My Soup was a disaster. It's just by the end of it, I came in, I sat down, I had a cigar and a notepad. We were in Michael's flat, all the cast met. Serving drinks round, and we sat down to read it. And before we'd got to the end of the first act, you could see this thing wasn't working, it wasn't any good. John Pertwee resorted to doing funny voices to get laughs at the end. And at the end of it all, Michael said, that was disgraceful. Donald was terrible. I'm going to complain to his agent in the morning. And I said to him, Michael, it's not Donald, it's me. And Bob Chetwynd realised this too. And I said, we've got to do something about this. I said, you need something to set tomorrow. I'll go home and I'll rewrite Act 1, Scene 1 now so that you can set it tomorrow. And I went home that night and rewrote Act 1, Scene 1 so that we would have, we had 2 or 3 weeks rehearsal, so that we would have something to put on the stage. And in that first week of the 3 weeks rehearsal, I rewrote the whole play from end to end. So that I said, something viable that you and I know will stand up for a rep audience, for a provincial audience, for a tour. And we opened in Wimbledon. And our opening night was all right. And then I went home again and rewrote the play from end to end again, all with Bob's guidance. Robert Chetwynd deserves every possible piece of credit for the success of that play. He was wonderful. And he kept his head when some leading actors, if they had all the changes that Donald had, would have gone mad and said, no, I'm not doing anymore. And Donald couldn't get this peacock of a man, this man who just didn't give a toss about women or anything. And the girl was, Barbara was on the ball right away, so was John Pertwee, the other leading part, and the boy. And Donald couldn't get it. He'd got a very good record at the Royal Shakespeare, and he'd done business plays, and he'd done those things like Doctor in the House and so on. Come on, chaps, let's go down there and get the girl, shall we? And farces where he was a married man being caught. And so, for instance, when he's caught with one girl by another woman in the play, he didn't give a toss, but he was playing it like a guilty husband in a farce, and I was detailed by Bob when I was doing the rewrites. I used to drive around, I used to say, Donald, could you give me a lift to Nottingham this week? We're going out. So I sat in the car trying to get to Donald. And we did our four of our 6 week tour and we came to Brighton. And suddenly the whole thing had the look of the West End about it. But Donald still wasn't right. And there's one point when he had a line saying, the two women are discussing, they're bitching each other in front of him, and he said, please, you mustn't fight over me, I'm not worth it, I'm not worth it. Now, he played this like a guilty husband, said, please, you mustn't fight, I'm not. And we said, no, it's the exact opposite, Donald. He's delighted that they're fighting over him. So I couldn't get him to do that, but I said, well, Donald, will you not do anything? Just stand up on the stage and just say it for tonight, for us. So he's just stood up there and said, please, you mustn't fight over me, I'm not worth it. Bang, A laugh came back from the audience where there'd never been a laugh before. You saw three actors on the stage go, wow. And then Donald got it. And he had a week at Brighton and a week at Golders Green before we opened. And he worked on this peacock thing. And when we opened, he was wonderful. And by the time we'd been on for 6 months, he was so far over the top, you couldn't believe it. And he gave this performance that he frankly gave for the rest of his life. I'm not being rude, I love him. I mean, this is true. And Bob Chetwynd and I would always say, we invented Donald Sinton. I went in to see him after he'd been on about, he was just coming out, nearly a year on, you see. And he went in, oh, Frizzles, hello, I'm delighted to see you, how are you? And I said, I'm fine, Donald, just thought I'd come in and see it. You know, Trevor Nunn was in last night. Now, you know I'm playing Foppington in The Relapse. For the Royal Shakespeare. I said, yes, I've read about that, Donald. Good, good. I hope you enjoy it. Trevor Nunn was in last night and he came round and he said, Donald, what I want is a caricature of this performance. And I said to him, Donald, that is not possible. he looked at me. Ha, 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 same old Frizzers. Another one you couldn't get through. You
know. Talk about soup. I mean, there were lots of cooks stirring this particular broth. Do you think Donald Sinden was almost driven to the point of nervous collapse by the sort of rewrites and the demands on him?
I meant to say, when I was following him around, driving around in his car with him, you see, I said to him, Donald, he's this and this. He said, it's all very well, Frizzers, you tell me what he's like, but how do I know what he's like when you keep changing him? Well, I changed the dialogue, but I didn't change the character. But, I mean, that was a pretty fair comment from Donald, actually. He was being buggered about so much by his director and his author.
So it was almost noises off at points in terms of the kind of unfolding chaos, and then it became all right on the night. And was there a moment when that opening night on Shaftesbury Avenue happened and you knew? I mean, did you know how much of a bankable hit it was? At what point?
When we were in Brighton, it looked like it. It just looked good. It looked good. It looked West End. It looked great. Suddenly changed that. And just the Brighton audience as opposed to Wolverhampton and Cardiff and Nottingham. A friend of mine came in who I'd worked with in Rep, and he was quite well known by then. He came in and said, it'll run for a year, Terry. And I said, no. So I bet against him on that. And I said, he said, well, you're betting against yourself. I said, well, on the basis if it does run for a year, I can afford the fiver. So, yes, there was talk it was going to run forever. Not forever, it was going to do well. From Brighton on, we looked good.
Yes, and the critics concurred. You didn't worry that there would be a kind of snobbish Fleet Street reaction to it?
Well, my reaction to my reviews was, I thought they were mediocre. I didn't think too much of them. And Michael's reaction was they're great selling reviews. And my agent said, have you seen your... He was gleeful on the phone to me the next morning. Have you seen your reviews? And I hadn't. I'd gone to bed. Because I'd stayed up for the Subtopians and done that terrible thing of staying up for the reviews and got a slap in the face. So I never did it again.
Yes. So that was a golden year for England, wasn't it? We won the World Cup, 1966.
Yeah.
The last great year, perhaps. But you from then on, you were walking on air for a while. It was kind of, it must have seemed very unreal that suddenly
it was a transformation.
Your life, you went from the hard shoulder to the fast lane, but you were catapulted.
I was, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'd had TV plays on. I was not poverty stricken. I was being mildly successful writing things and acting. And Christine, my ex-wife, was a mildly successful model, photographic model, not catwalk. And then suddenly, the world was transformed. I mean, it's like, I've said it before, it's like standing under a shower bath of gold. I mean, it should happen to everybody once in your life. And I did everything properly and it all went wrong.
Mm.
Income tax then was 19 shillings and sixpence in the pound, 97.5% on the top rate. And I was clearly going to make a big killing in 2 or 3 years, and then it was going to stop. And I had to make up my mind, am I going to save that from tax, or am I going to pay all that tax out and end up not so very different afterwards, you know? So I made the decision to become a foreign resident, set up foreign trusts, and do all those tax avoidance things. And people used to say to me, what happened to your socialist principles? And I said, well, that's why I should continue to vote Labour. People need protecting from people like me.
And was there I know we didn't really refer to the catchphrase of the play, which is one of the reasons why it had such currency so quickly, I suppose. My God, but you're lovely. Had that popped into your head early on in the script or later on, or how did it, when did it come from?
Pay another tribute to Donald. No, it's my line. It just went into the script, and I just thought, oh, he's going to say this to every woman, which he does. It's an automatic. But it's the last line of the play as well, when he says it to himself, as you remember. And he's left alone. The girl's dumped him. He's gone, and she's cooked him a meal, and he's just had a phone call for this other woman, and he's going to give the meal that his girlfriend has cooked for him, he's going to give it to another female, betraying his love. And he's just sitting on the bed and picks up the mirror and looks in it and says to himself, my God, but you're lovely. Wonderful last line for the play. Donald thought of that. I hadn't put it there. I just had him sitting lonely at the end and the curtain coming down.
Brilliant. So it all wrapped together.
Yeah.
I suppose what's interesting about it socially is that people weren't even apparently talking about the male chauvinist pig at that point, or rather, he almost became an embodiment of that.
I don't think the phrase was invented.
And then you also put this sort of forthright, clever, young woman of the 60s. Mm. In the middle of the swinging 60s, there was a girl who knew her way around these rather treacherous bedroom moments.
Yes.
Was there a model for that? I suppose maybe that's very much was in the air, wasn't it?
But girl was me, is the answer. The girl, the model for her mannerisms and how she acted and behaved, which got a lot of the laughs and so on, was a friend of my ex-wife's, a girl called Caroline Cramp. She was married to a restaurateur, and she was. I used to watch her, and when Christine and I were out with her and Peter, her husband, and I thought, that's today, that's right now, and I noted and copied things she did. Some of the other little bits of the girl in Girl in My Suit are Christine, my ex-wife, obviously she crept in there. But what she has to say, her arguments and her view, it's pure me. Cool. It's a feminist play. The perception of the play now is that it's a farce. Oh, that farce from the 60s. It's not a farce. It's nothing like it. Nothing farcical about it. And that film, which I called A Jolly Romp with Peter and Goldie, increase that thing. There's no content in that film. There's no argument in that film, which is at the core of the play. And of course, her other boyfriend, her down-market working-class boyfriend, is just as much of a male chauvinist as they're both male chauvinists, aren't they? Up-market and down-market, and she is aware of both of what shits they both are. She's fully aware, and so the play is not regarded at all as I think it should be. Which is as a social comedy of its era. Whether it's good, bad or indifferent is another point, but to call it a farce just drives me mad.
So
add one last thing there? Michael said, McCodran said at the time, this was indicative of my worshipping of John Osborne and my rep years when I learned about structural plays and so on. He said, it's a bridge play. It's a bridge play between the new wave and the old, and I think that's what it was.
People flocked to it partly because they wanted to see that world on stage, and it hadn't necessarily had that articulation before of this is how it works between men and women these days. It's not, there is a lot more, sexual friction or confusion going on. I mean, I suppose when you say bridge play, it's also describing a bridge between...
Well, the new wave and the old, of the theatrical bridge.
Both artistically, but also socially. There's a bridge between...
Two classes there,
Her indoors, suddenly coming out of doors and saying, I'm going to do what I want. I mean, I suppose, do you think it could be revived? If it were to be revived now, it has to remain in that period. It has to remain contextual, do you think?
I would be very interested to see, would it stand up if you just set it 2017? I don't know. I think it would, but then that may be the fond author imagining that his play is so wonderful. It might be better set in the 60s, and so you look at it through the wrong end of eternity. I don't know.
So you this play, as you say, went on for 1 year, the second year, the third year. It became almost unstoppable and immovable. And in the midst of that, you, as you say, there was the film. Were you enthusiastic about Peter Sellers when he was first cast? Was there a feeling at the beginning that it would work?
I'm afraid the film, because the film took 1970, they made the film. There was such a fart about in trading between film producers with the script. I wrote the script of it in 67, and then I didn't hear anything for 3 years. And I just, I said to the producer, I handed the draft script to, I've left most a lot of things in the stage play in there, because I think they've, but they should be edited, and I've written the linking part, the things that make the film, in there. So what you're getting, Nat, is rather a long draft. He said, yes, I understand, yeah, yes, I understand. And I said, I think the director and I should cut it down to the right size, mutually between us. He said, fine. And then he came back to me a month or so later, well, when he read it, and said, we're very disappointed in the script, Terry. It's very long. I said, yes, but I told you that. Yes, it's very long and very wordy. I didn't hear anything for 3 years. Then I was phoned by the Bolting brothers and told they'd got the rights now. They'd been asked to do it by Columbia, Mike Frankovich, and Peter was going to play it. I thought to myself, well, that sounds all right. Should be okay, I don't know. And I went in to see them, and they had a pile of scripts. Hollywood had spent more money having that script rewritten by Americans, whatever, and Roy Bolting and I worked our way through all those scripts. There wasn't a line, usable line in any of them for it. And we went back to my original draft and edited it. Now, that should have been all right. Unfortunately, Roy was 60-something, and he always, every time we were talking, he referred to this young man, meaning Robert Davenport. And I said, no, Roy, he's the middle-aged man. You know, it's this, and he had totally the wrong view on it. He had no understanding. End of that. And it just turned out jolly wrong. And once you've got an American girl, you've pulled away one of the class things straight away, haven't you? That's gone.
Were you annoyed to see your kind of great play traduced in a way on screen?
Did I didn't realise how bad it was until I saw it finished. You hope you've done it. I wrote the script. I got an award for the script, for Christ's sake. You know, I've got to hold my hand up. But I thought what I saw on the screen, I just thought was nonsense.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Dominic Cavendish and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum. Thanks for listening.